If you want to get your favorite technical news, give Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 187. I'm actually calling this show Moisture Farming. Matt and I are going to talk about a whole bunch of tech things related to what I'm air quoting, which you can't see on an audio podcast, but green energy, as well as, and we're going to also talk at the end a little bit about the some of the things that are going on in the green automobile industry, because it kind of relates. So before starting this, Matt and I were kind of chatting about the about this episode a little bit, and kind of want you know to kind of fire us up. So Bloomberg has a newsletter anybody can sign up for. I highly recommend it if you really want to know what's going on in the world. Bloomberg and Forbes seem to, because they tell their stories with numbers. They don't tend to have a lot of hyperbole or exaggeration or editorialization, because they're just stating the facts as the numbers are crunched. But they have a Supply Lines is a newsletter that you get 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and it's about the logistics. And they talk about everything from, you know, transportation to technology to energy to you name it. If it has a logistics component to it, they talk about it. And the one that came out recently talked about energy. And one of the things they were saying is that, well, China, we already know that China's been having a huge energy crunch. It's only going to get worse, and it's going to continue through 2021 and probably through most of 2022. And part of that is they can't get coal to fire their electric plants, and they, right at a time when they need to increase production to meet the Western world's, you know, the United States and Western Europe's Christmas demand. And then on top of that, you have the transportation logistics issues, where we went from August of only having 40 ships backlogged at the port of Los Angeles to September, the beginning of September, which had 83 ships backlogged, to now 94 container ships backlogged. So if you order something today and it has to be shipped from China, you will not get it until 2022. Probably not till February of 2022. And the industry I work in is my day job. We're encountering this all the time because we order tech equipment and we're getting shipment dates in January and February for things like power strips. That's how bad it is. You cannot get a 24-port power strip until January of 2022. You can't get fiber optic cable. You can't get... And so this it's pretty serious. But one of the things that really struck me about the Supply Lines about energy was that they said in the U.S. that this year, this winter, that natural gas prices, which were already up, are going to be 2x what they were last year at the same time. So we better pray that the United States, this global warming helps us out, and the United States does not have a hard winter. Because those places where they're heated by natural gas and it's a hard winter, it is going to double your natural gas bill. Which, when I lived in a house that had a forced air furnace, that part of the bill was double what my electrical usage was every month until the summertime when, you know, the furnace got turned off. And so that leads me into, you know, some of these other things, like, and I have noticed a precipitous increase in my electric bill at home. And we do not, by the way, I do not use electric heating. It's still too hot where we are in Southern Ohio to even worry about turning the heat on. Although I've been really,
I turned the air conditioning off.
Well, the fans on the air conditioners are on, but they have not been coming on, which is, you know, the compressor is what sucks all the juice. But that being said, you know, the whole idea of rationing comfort because the bill is outrageous. Because my electric bill, I had two things happen. One, the faux concept of choice from electrical supplier, my agreement ran out, and so they more than tripled the amount of money from my electrical supplier per kilowatt hour. So I had to sign up for a new one, but I got hit with a bill in between that doubled my electric bill for a month, and which made me then start doing some back of the, you know, I'm in previous podcasts, Matt and I have talked about, I believe in personal energy independence. Now, if that for you, and that again, this is a libertarian idea. If for you, personal energy independence means you're grid tied and you're happy with that and you live with that, or if it's me who I think I don't want to be grid tied anymore, but I haven't made the big plunge. I mean, over the years, I've been buying equipment and solar panels, good quality solar panels, you know, which, and there's some issues with that too, and we'll kind of go into that idea. But I started doing back of the napkin math, and I figured out that I could buy with 2 years at this horrible rate, I could easily afford a 4 or 5 kilowatt system, solar system at my house, which would easily run multiple air conditioners, would run our electric dryer, would run our fuel oil furnace, would run the water heater, would run all the computers that I run, and provide me a huge excess even through the winter. Right now that is really, really appealing, except for the fact that if I ordered all the solar panels I wanted today, I wouldn't get them until probably July of next year, because solar panels that I ordered in November last year didn't get to me until February, March of this year. So, and that was then, and that wasn't because there was a huge logistics backup because of COVID. That was because there was such a demand on solar panels, particularly 200 watt or better solar panels, that I was just in the queue to get when I could get.
Where are those being manufactured?
So, I mean, do you remember the scene in Armageddon when they save the Russian astronaut and he's in the back because they had landed on the asteroid and they need to leave with their space shuttle so that they can detonate the nuclear weapon to blow it away? And he's back there and says, I can fix this. And he opens up an electrical panel in the back of the shuttle and he's raking it with a wrench and sparks are flying. And they're going, what are you doing? And he goes, Russian, American, it's all made in China. Well, that's where a lot of the solar panels are made. And a lot of that equipment, you know. I don't know that there might be a solar panel vendor. I mean, a lot of it's, again, is designed in the United States, but it's manufactured elsewhere. We're starting to see more quality solar stuff come out of India as a secondary, you know, as companies are diversifying their supply chain. But a lot of the really good solar companies are actually headquartered in China. Not because China's using a lot of solar power, because their whole thing is, you know, their industrial electrical problem is because they can't get coal and natural gas. Because Russia's hoarding what they've got. And, but, you know, that means that, like, if I ordered, you know, 5 panels today, which would be a kilowatt of power, I would be waiting at least until January or February of 2022 until I received those. Just on the logistics alone, not even if they, that would mean that they were sitting and they put them today, if I ordered today, they put it on a, you know, put it in a container and put it on a ship and shipped it today. When you're 94 days backlogged, we're already out past Christmas at this point.
Have you been following that? Because I don't understand what the real problem is. The ships are just hanging out. Right?
Yeah, so there,
it's port workers.
It's part of it is. So part of it is so in the United States, when we take things in, there are, in reality, there's only three ports that take in probably 95% of all of the goods that are shipped from other parts in the world. You have the dual ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach in California, and then you have the port of Savannah in Georgia on the East Coast. And Long Beach and L.A. ports, they probably take in the lion's share of that even. And then we ship from there across country via semi or train. And so what's happening is there's a labor shortage at the ports on just dock workers to unload the ships and pull the containers apart and all of that. There's a space shortage because both the ports of LA and Long Beach are not big enough to handle the amount of cargo that's coming in, because if they had space to just unload the ships, they could unload them and, you know, put the cargo containers, which would then allow Customs and Border Patrol to do their job. But because they can't unload them fast enough and there's so many ships out at sea, CBP can't go out there and do, you know, clear that material, because that's part of the issue too. It wouldn't be 94 days if CBP didn't need to, you know, verify the manifests and everything else. That adds at least 7 days, probably 14 on most cargoes. Then CBP has a labor shortage. They don't have enough Customs Border Patrol agents to be able to go in and even inspect the amount of cargo that's sitting on shore at the ports. I mean, it's just kind of, it's all dominoes, and they all fell. And some of them have fallen the wrong way. And, you know, as exports from, and as imports have increased in the United States and exports have increased from other countries, the backlog just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. If it stays at this rate, there will be 6 months of shipments sitting outside of Long Beach and LA's harbors, which, by the way, are so close to each other, they might as well be one large complex alone, you know.
This is going to sound weird coming from me, but if only there were a population of people coming to this country looking for jobs that Americans won't do.
Well, it's not. I mean, dock workers make fairly good bang.
But clearly, not enough Americans are wanting to do this job.
Well, so, but, you know, one of the things that we've kind of ignored when we talk about the labor shortage in the United States, yes, the federal government's done some really stupid things.
Of course.
One, they allowed, and the funny thing is you can say that I'm, you know, barking up the conservative side on this, but it is actually a problem so bad that there's several very liberal economists who have said the same thing. They're like, this giving people all this extra money for as COVID relief does not encourage them to go back out and find jobs. And so we have a labor shortage because the government has created it. The other issue is that, and we really haven't talked about this, is that the largest generation of people, in the United States, which are the baby boomers, even the youngest of the baby boomers are now at retirement age. And because of COVID, a lot of them just said, screw it, I'm retiring and I'm done. And so it took a whole lot of workers out of the workforce, experienced workers. And so what's happened is there's been this precipitous move up because those people, a lot of them were senior engineers, senior managers, you know, whatever. They were replaced by the people below them who are younger. Well, every generation subsequent to that is smaller. And part of the reason we have a fast food crunch right now is, you know, in the service industry is, and they're paying, I mean, some of these places are paying $18 an hour. I'm talking Ohio.
Yeah.
Ohio is not a place where we upped our minimum wage to even $10 an hour. the Wendy's near where I live is offering $15 to $18 an hour, and they're accepting 14 and 15-year-olds, which requires a waiver by the state, by the way, if you're 14 to even get a job.
And some of these places are offering sign-on bonuses.
They're like $300 or $400 sign-on bonus to come work part-time at McDonald's or Wendy's or KFC. The only fast food joint I know that doesn't seem to be suffering for workers is Chick-fil-A. The funny thing is Ohio's fairly open. If a restaurant wanted to open their lobby and have people come in and sit down, they could, but most of our fast food restaurants can't do that because there's not enough workers. And the reason there's not enough workers is because there are job opportunities for kids who are 17 and 18 years old to actually get real jobs, and they're filling those jobs. But there's, because the generations, it's a reverse triangle. The generations are smaller and smaller and smaller. There's fewer of these kids working.
But again, that's why I come back and say, if only there was a population of people that were coming to this country looking for employment.
Yes.
The
other issue with that is training, qualification, and education.
But you know what? That's a problem that's solvable in a relatively short amount of time if these people apply themselves and utilize the system in the way it was intended. Government has to get out of the way.
Yes and no. Part of it, short amount of time, we have to define that. 1 to 2 years, absolutely. 30 days, no. Because a lot of these people who are wanting to immigrate into the United States, they don't have the basic skills for reading, writing, or math that, an elementary-aged student has, because where they came from, there were no educational opportunities at all.
Agreed, but again, that's a problem that can be solvable.
It can be solved, but it's not...
And should have been solved, but, because this is a thing that's... This didn't just happen yesterday. We've been talking about
How about
the demographic?
Yeah. Well, let's look at it from another perspective, a demographic. Say we can't use the immigrants. Say that's a 2 year out, 3 year out problem. Where do we have a whole bunch of people we could throw into, particularly physical labor and things like that, offer them job skills and things like that? Well, how about all the nonviolent criminals? All the people who are in jail who got picked up and, are serving time for possession of, more than an ounce of marijuana and stuff like that, because they're all required when they get on parole to have a job.
There's no reason not to do those things. And in fact, I believe that state legislatures have a responsibility to start looking at this problem and stop waiting for D.C. to figure it out, because D.C. is never going to figure it out. This is going to come down to the states saying, here's a problem, here's a solution, here's our stopgap solution, we need all hands on deck. And right now we don't have that.
I agree with you. I think that's very true. I think that's very true. So I'm going to segue a little bit.
Please do.
Because I look at government, particularly from the federal and state levels, but even the local level has fallen into this. And oddly enough, Andrew Yang in an interview today, talked about that people in, people who have political power, they don't think the same way, and it changes your thought process. And so I've been rereading the book Foundation by Isaac Asimov, mainly because the Apple TV series came out, and I couldn't remember the differences between the actual book and what's going on in the series, which has only had 3 episodes so far. My biggest complaint is they've Starbucked a couple of characters.
Of course.
And stuff. It's not super important because it doesn't affect the things, the story. But And the other big thing that I've noticed about it is, I'm assuming Foundation is actually going to cover the 6 books that Isaac Asimov wrote, because some of the material that they've gone over is in Prelude to Foundation, and some of it's in Foundation, and, you know, and as we go forward, it'll be in Second Foundation and Foundation and Earth and the other books. But I've been rereading Foundation, and who was it? And I know I'm going to end up paraphrasing this because I don't remember the exact quote, but, you know, those are doomed to failure who do not, or, you know, who want to repeat history or don't, you know, learn anything from history.
Fail to study history are doomed to repeat it, I think is the quote.
So or close to it. You're reading Foundation. And so if you're not familiar with it, it's a phenomenal set of books. As a matter of fact, every book and short story that Isaac Asimov wrote is actually part of this Foundation story, from iRobot to Foundation and Earth. But Foundation really covers this galactic empire has been around for 12,000 years. They thought they were too big to fail. And politically, everybody kind of stagnated. And so what happened is the empire fell apart. Parts of this great galactic space government turned to barbarism and all this. And this guy named Harry Seldon, who was a mathematician, created psychohistory, which was a way to look at, and we talk about this today in data analytics. It was basically, he was a data scientist, and he figured a way to predict the future based upon hugely large populations of people. And in this galactic empire, there were over 2,500 million human-populated worlds. So it was not just billions of people, it was trillions and trillions and trillions of people. And he predicted the fall of the galactic empire, and what he wanted to do, he created what was called the Foundation, which is a bunch of scientists, one, to protect the knowledge that they were going to lose in this darkened time, and to shorten that darkened time from 10,000 years to 1,000 years. But when, as you read the book and you read the things that are going on today in the news, there are so many corollaries. And and you can, in my mind, every time I read it, I'm likening the United States and Western Europe to the Galactic Empire. But you can take almost any government in the world, and you can apply these principles that you're reading from this book to. And I think we've got a great stagnation in thinking. And the sad part of it is, it's in one of the times when we've had the most incredible technological advances that we've ever seen. You know, which is saying a lot. Because, you know, if you look at the 20th century, was just, it was 100 years of great advance, both scientific and intellectual.
I mean, start with flight.
Okay, let's go before flight. Let's start with the automobile. Combustion engines. How about the fact that a lot of the early automobiles were electric? You know? But, you know, even things like high-speed intercontinental trains, something we don't have in the United States, but something that's flourished in other parts of the world. Flight, you know, essentially a powered glider to, you know, jet aircraft.
Not only that, but we've taken the principles of flight and applied it to lunar excursions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's within 100 years.
Yep.
I mean, really, 60.
Yeah, really, it's 60-ish. And what about microprocessors and computers and stuff? You know, back when they created the first computers to help crack the codes of the Enigma machines, you're talking about warehouses. Warehouses full of one computer that isn't as powerful as my digital watch was in the 80s, you know? Or a calculator, you know? Which most people, you know, most kids today don't know what a digital watch or a calculator are. You know? But you know, this idea, you know, I don't want to say it's a sense of panic, but the idea that you become self-sufficient is highly predicated upon the fact that if you look at the economy, so let's talk about the economy. We're in the first year of $4 trillion, $5 trillion worth of spending. A lot of that will stop because it, you know, typically whoever is the majority in the House when an incoming president comes in, it flips
in midterms.
Whenever spending bills happen, I've never seen Congress, even when things flip in the midterms, go, let's repeal that. And that never comes up.
Well, the Obamacare aside, they talked a good game, but then didn't actually do it.
Yep.
Because the American people didn't hold them accountable. That's the problem that we have in our society.
But that's the stagnation from a society, because why do we have the accountability problem? Well, because
Americans can't be bothered.
Well, people
to learn about why our economy sucks.
Well, there's that. They would rather complain about it, but two, they feel powerless that, you know, whoever is in office is going to do what whoever is in office, and that's why we have such a poor voter turnout. You know, which it's funny, you know, we just had Facebook again recently, and, you know, we're all of Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram and all that. And, you know, I actually didn't miss it whatsoever. Your job requires Facebook, so.
So, I mean, I was kind of somewhat panicked, but if I didn't have other things that I needed to do yesterday,
yeah,
I would have panicked. Yesterday.
But, you know, I lost my train of thought there. But, you know, because we people get these, how do you want to say it? Facebook propagates bad information. It doesn't matter whether somebody tells the truth or doesn't tell the truth. The way it's designed, it's like a giant game of telephone. Except what happens is somebody puts their opinion out there, and that's the problem, is they put their opinion out there and other people read it because they either agree with it or they disagree with it.
Now, here's where I will tell you why that's a problem. It's not that people are expressing their opinions, it's where it's at.
Correct.
Now, in the good old days of the internet, those of us who bloviated our opinions did so in what was called the blogosphere.
Exactly.
It was clearly zoned off as an area where you could say whatever you wanted.
But it was known that it was your opinion.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, even journalism has gotten to the point where it's not journalism
anymore. It's editorialism.
It's an editorial, and it's got an agenda behind it that's not yours and not mine.
Yeah. Well, I think it's got an agenda behind it that's not most people's. You know? But because people are so apathetic about everything, because there's also that fear and uncertainty of, well, is this really true or not? And, you know, Facebook's whole concept and Twitter and all this about fact-checking is idiotic because their fact checks are not correct 90% of the time. You know, people make posts and they'll say, this is my opinion. And then there'll be a thing that says, well, the fact check says this is untrue. Really, his opinion is untrue. I want to get off that. I hate Facebook. I think they're a necessary evil because there are some good things about Facebook. But I think Facebook shows a lot of the negative side of people in society.
But you know what, though? To me, I would much rather face that head on than keep it in the dark recesses.
Oh, I agree.
Because quite frankly, we have some real problems in this country and on this planet that aren't being talked about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, now that we kind of talked about the energy independence, did I actually finish that thought, though?
I think so.
I think so. So, recap. Just, you know, the whole idea. Oh, well, here's what I wanted to talk about in addition to that. So, there is a company, and it's the whole reason why I named this episode Moisture Farming, who has actually built vaporators that look like solar panels for desert communities, and they take humidity out of the air, and they capture it, and they're providing water, running water. And I'm not talking about, like, third world countries. This is happening in the western half of the United States. Like, we're Indian reservations. They're the largest population of Americans are Native Americans living on reservations who do not have running water. And part of it is because they would actually have to go someplace, like to a reservoir with water trucks and make trips. And I'm not talking about like the community, the reservation was making a trip, you know. Each individual home was making a trip 2 to 3 times a week to go get hundreds of gallons of water so that they have drinking water and water to bathe with and water to cook with and everything else. But this company, they're doing it, they've done it with 500 homes on a Navajo reservation in Arizona and New Mexico. And these devices are pulling enough water out of the air to have running water in these 500 homes. They're not hooked to any other water system.
Pardon my ignorance, but let me ask the question, is this a renewable source?
Yes, it should be. Because even in arid places, there is a level of humidity. Now, that level of humidity may only be, you know, there's no negative humidity, for one thing. So you can't, like, suck all the humidity out of a place and it won't. You won't get humidity back.
The equivalent of strip mining.
Correct. You can't do that because the way humidity works is, it follows the law of entropy. So if there's an area where it is taken away, humidity is going to be drawn from other areas. So there, now the level of humidity that they're drawing on, there could be some places where the level of humidity is so low that it would take forever to get it. But, you know, we're talking about areas of Arizona where it's probably 10 to 15%, maybe a little more humidity. It's not like here or in the southeast where we talk, you know, we're talking the middle of winter and we still have 99% humidity, you know. What's the name of this? One of the things is the air that we breathe holds 6 times as much water as the world's rivers. And
that's globally.
So, you know, the water vapor is converted to liquid and then filtered and then mineralized. So they're putting some electrolytes back in it so that it doesn't feel slimy or, you know, because if you've ever had over softened water, you try to wash soap off your hands and, you know, you feel like you've always got soap on them. But they're calling these hydro panels. And they're starting to sell them to resorts and restaurants and stores and homes. And again, this has application everywhere, these hydro panels.
Sure.
So, again, you know, there's a lot of land that we have not developed Which isn't good for it could be good for agriculture, but because there was no readily available water source than drilling wells, this could solve. It could also, you know, out west, you know, Arizona needs to, or City of Phoenix needs to expand. This is another way that they could expand it without expanding the water system, you know.
Well, and again, this is another one of those pieces of technology that could be used for independent living.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know...
True independent
living. So, you know, it's a really neat concept that kind of goes along with the... Because you only need two things to live at relative comfort in modern society. Running water and electricity. And, you know, in reality, we could get, almost every individual home could get by with a lot less electricity. But, you know, because the funny thing is, you know, technology has changed so much that, you know, even, you know, we look at these, it used to be if you had like a big tube TV, so you had like a 36-inch tube TV, those would draw, you know, 500 watts, 700 watts. A 75-inch flat panel LED TV draws like 100 watts, you know. And so a lot of our modern conveniences don't really take that much energy. Part of that was driven by the micronization of electronics. Part of it was driven by the fact that, you know, battery technology has not gotten better over, well, it's gotten better over time, but not in the drastic leaps and bounds that you would need it.
Technology sectors have.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so electronics have become a lot more efficient, you know, and that's the funny thing that people don't realize. Now, another article I found is that, that this could help potentially solve is that even in big cities, like San Francisco is a very good example, there is a huge population of people who don't have access to clean water or sewage. Now, you would think San Francisco, but there are a lot of people who because the cost of living is so high, they're living in sorry. But there's a lot of people who are living in buildings and stuff that, you know, to keep the rent low means that maintenance has not been done, which means that, you know, they have one bathroom per floor for 20 tenants. And those bathrooms are constantly in disrepair. You know, we talk about programs to fix things. I honestly think government needs to get out of the way in a lot of this, because part of the cost of living issue has, again, in some of these places, particularly large cities, is because landlords and people have been subsidized, you know, to keep well, New York is a good example with rent control. So... in New York, in my opinion, you know, is still an unlivable place monetarily for most people.
Yeah.
You know, I know people who are making a lot more money than I am per year, and they're living in, you know, a studio apartment, you know, and paying three times what I pay in a farm payment per month. You know, and I keep saying, you know. People, you know, but you know, but those things are things that I think would change, because if you talk, if none of you know about Lewis Rossman is probably the one of the main focal points of the right to repair movement in the United States. I agree with him on a lot of things. I disagree with him on a lot of others. But one of the things he's been doing, and he has a YouTube channel, and sometimes it is pedantic and boring what he talks about. But one of the things that fascinates me is he's been, he runs a repair business, computer repair business, where they do board level repairs and stuff, particularly on Apple products. And he's been going around New York because COVID has killed a lot of businesses. And he rides a bike around, and so he'll take his camera and he'll pick massive, like huge sections of New York City, and he'll ride up and down all the streets and the blocks, and he'll show you vacant building after vacant building after vacant building, and they're building more buildings. That's the dumb thing about it. And it seems to me that because you talk about how everything works, so businesses have moved out of big cities, New York being a good example, that means residents are going to have to move out of big cities because they need to go where the work is. And they're going to go, if they find work and the work is paying the same amount of money as it was before, but the cost of living is a third or a half of what it was in New York City.
That's actual real wealth.
Correct. Correct.
If I were a company that were headquartered in New York City and I actually cared about my employees, I would move the hell out of there.
Well, you know, so here's the flip side of the argument, because he wants to take his repair business and move somewhere else. He did a whole series of videos where he and his girlfriend went to Miami. They went to Nashville, you know, all of these places, which are nice places to live, and could support his business, making the same amount, if not more, money per year. But his concern was, you know, can I get my employees to move? Because he's not a large business, but you know, if you were a large corporation like an IBM, a Cisco, you know, whoever, and you moved, say, even if you moved from one big city to another, but you moved from like New York City to Omaha, Nebraska. I mean, there's a good amount of infrastructure in Omaha, Nebraska. You know, all the major insurance companies started there, Mutual of Omaha and all those guys. But the cost of living would be a fraction of what it would be in New York City. Now, as more companies moved out, that cost of living can go up. Washington, D.C. is another place where it's almost impossible to live. I always chuckle at this when I think back about it, but you can find YouTube videos and newspaper articles. When AOC was first elected into office, she couldn't move to D.C. because she couldn't afford rent, and she lived in New York City.
True story.
So, it's a lot to think about. So going back to the automotive stuff, since we wrap that up, because I want to attach this, because this is green, about green automotive technology. I got to find the right one. So one of the big things that we've talked about why the automotive industry is suffering is the chip shortage. Now, I don't buy this argument, but on Slashdot, somebody was making the argument that it wasn't just somebody. It was Jalopnik, which is a well-known... They started out as a blog. Now they're a supposed automotive news site. But that it's hard... Because there was an article that came out by Ars Technica saying that part of the reason the industry is suffering so much is because they're using antiquated chip technology. They have not embraced the micronization of chips. They're not using modern chips. I would say that's probably the exception to that is Tesla, and that's why I think this argument by Jalopnik, which is that the reason they can't switch to these chips is because they're not as reliable. And so you wouldn't put these in a car that's moving at 90 miles an hour. One, yes, self-driving, as much as we want to talk about it, we like to, you know, laugh at Tesla's self-driving cars that have accidentally hit deer or killed people or whatever else, I don't know that many people who have kits from Knight Rider, and they're driving around in them, and they're self-driving, you know, taking a nap while they're moving, you know, commuting to work every morning. That doesn't exist. So that, yes, are automotive makers all trying to jump on this bandwagon to have self-driving cars? Yes, but is it going to really be a reality in my lifetime? I don't think so. There's too many variables, and it's not the chip technology or the software that's the problem. The problem is humans. Humans and animals are not logical. Even when they act logical for a certain point in time, they will do something that is totally illogical and irrational, and these self-driving computers can't handle that. They can't handle a deer. I mean, humans can't handle a deer running across the road in front of them. How do you think a car is supposed to do that? Now, can it react faster? Yeah, but is it going to react faster to determine whether it needs to speed up or does it have enough room to stop? We're not there yet. Because it's obvious if we were, then the self-driving cars like Teslas that are out there today would have been able to avoid the deer that have wrecked these cars.
Now, I think we're probably closer to technology that would, and I hate this idea, so start with that, but William Shatner's Tech War has a thing called the Adway. The cars are self-driving, and they prevent accidents, and they get you where you gotta go, and you don't have to drive, but if I remember correctly, they had to manually drive to get onto the Adway.
Correct. Well, I mean, it's similar
which
concept.
Is a smarter thing to go for.
Well, it's similar concept with, like, Minority Report. Remember?
Yeah.
They drove their cars on the local streets, but when they got on the major highways and thoroughfares, the car was automatic. You know, and again, I agree with you. I don't know that I want it to go that way. I like the independence of being able to drive my own car. Although there have been many long car trips where I wish I had a kit, you know. But that's going to require more of a central programming thing that you would log into, and your car is then taken over by something that controls all the other cars, as opposed to each car being independently...
Right. Agreed. And I think even the Adway thing is based on that concept.
Well, I mean, we've seen it in science fiction for the last couple of decades. The Tech War, Minority Report, what was the Wesley Snipes, Sylvester Stallone movie?
Demolition Man.
The cars were self-driving when they got on the highway.
Even Fifth Element to a certain degree. Although,
nah,
not as much.
Fifth Element was more like Star Wars with Coruscant. You know,
where
everybody's driving these speeders at outrageous speeds, and you just kind of merge into traffic. And but the other problem is there's this balance too. I'm sure we have the technology today to actually make a car that would be at least as capable as a human, in the sense of keeping you safe and could self-drive. The problem is cost to the consumer.
Right.
Because those cars would need to give them the operational capability, and we're adding this now. I can see driver assist stuff being a bigger thing. You know, you look at some of the new cars just in the last couple of years. You know, where they have sensors in your blind spots, and so they tell you if a car is passing you, and it's passing through your blind spot by flashing a light in your.
That technology I love and adore. When the car makes decisions for me,
yeah,
I don't like that.
Well, you know, the other issue is that, again, you know, we've talked about the whole idea of the, you know, in past episodes about cars, you know, how they're going to tax cars, you know, which the new idea is let's add a per mile tax, which exists in commercial vehicles and exists in other countries. There's a reason that Great Britain and New Zealand and Australia all have, when people go camping, they don't, it's not that the roads there can't accept a big RV, but a big RV has to have a per mile thing. So people, you know, drive these little cars with these these campers, you know, caravans on the back.
And you're talking about tiny countries in comparison to the United States. Those solutions are for small countries.
Yes. Well, you know, the issue, I don't know,
one size fits all.
Well, here's the problem I have with the, because we're going to segue into this now.
Okay.
I have with the per mile tax is that if they issue a per mile tax, are they going to suspend
the gasoline tax?
Because you're still talking 20, 30 years before the majority of vehicles on the road are going to be electric.
Agreed. But the problem is, if you're going to plan for the future and you're going to make the future be now, you got to dispense with the past system.
Correct.
But the problem is, politicians never want to give up their money.
Mm-hmm.
This is a money source for them.
Well, the other issue
not going away.
Well, and the other issue I have with it. Well, and maybe they're only going to do a per mile tax on electric vehicles. It's not clear according to what's in the infrastructure bill. But the other issue is 8 cents a mile, which is what the average of what they're talking about, is far greater than what we pay now with the gasoline tax. Because a gallon of gasoline will get you 20 or 30 miles. So even if you paid 20 cents a gallon of taxes on a gallon, or 22 cents of taxes on a gallon of gas between state, federal, and local, it only ends up being about 1 cent per 1 cent per mile, or 1.2 cents per mile.
You want to know what the really stupid thing about the program that's being introduced in the infrastructure bill?
Go ahead.
It's another blue ribbon program. This isn't a, hey, let's do it. This is yet another study. So what they're going to do is they're going to take Iowa, and I don't know that it's going to be Iowa, I'm just saying, some state is going to get stuck with this. You're going to get the gas tax that you got to shell out. You're going to have the per mile tax you're going to have to shell out. And then what's going to happen is the Iowa Department of Taxation is going to report their findings to the federal government and return all that money. This is government. This is a government job. Nonsense that doesn't actually produce anything.
Yeah, I agree.
But more paper.
So one of the other things, I wish Sean was here to talk to us about this since he's a GM fan. But GM is trying to change themselves from being an automaker to being a technology platform maker. And so they're going to broaden, because they're broadening almost all their cars into EVs at this point, they're going to position themselves as a software developer for cars. Which I think is hilarious, because do you think Toyota is going to go to GM to go, hey, can we use your software in our car? How about Ford? Ford has more electric cars than GM does at this point, at least good ones.
Well, I mean, this is the age-old iOS versus Android.
Yeah.
the manufacturer is not going to go to a manufacturer.
Another. No. Well, and you got to ask yourself, because everything I've read from all the pundits and all the people in the know say that, frankly, Tesla's software is not just like 10 years or 20 years ahead of everybody else as far as, you know, running the car and the diagnostics and the self-driving and everything else. They're like leaps and bounds ahead of that, you know, 50 to 80 years ahead of everybody else. And so for a long time, they were saying
because they were a technology company that was building a car.
Correct.
When you reverse that,
yeah, you're a car company who's adding, hey, let's throw a computer on it. So let's make the entertainment system the hub of our vehicle. Oh, security, what's that? You mean somebody can take over and accelerate the car via Bluetooth? Because we didn't do this, and well, how do you patch the radio? Well, there is no patching because it's firmware that's not upgradable. What do we do? Because we are a car company, you know? And that's the thing that I think is laughable about this chip thing as well. You know, GM complaining, and I mean, you can drive by the... I've said this probably every podcast that we've had in the last 10 podcasts. You can drive by the Speedway in northern Kentucky, which is close to the big Ford truck plant, and it's just full of F-150s, F-250s, F-350s. I mean, as far as the eye can see, because they don't have chips that can go in them to run. And I'm sitting here going, you know, we had cars that ran and were very efficient before chips. You need to meet the federal mandate? Well, maybe fuel injection isn't the way to go, because back in the 50s, somebody at General Motors invented a carburetor that would get 80 miles to the gallon on a V8.
Shocking.
Also, General Motors in the 80s developed a portable marine engine that didn't have any exhaust. Where are those today? You know, and you know, that kind of segues me into the last thing I want to talk about in this, since we're talking about climate and pollution and energy and all of that, is there was a Slashdot article, let me pull it back up, where, right here, I want to see who this article is linked to. Okay, so the California Air Resources Board, CARB, which I think is funny, let's name that, put a report out saying that two-stroke leaf blowers and weed whips and, you know, all the things that power your lawn equipment are the most, produce more ozone and toxic chemical pollution than all the cars in the United States combined. And the argument is that two-stroke engines, which are fairly efficient, they do run, a two-stroke engine requires that you mix the oil. They don't have a separate oiler to lubricate the parts. You mix the oil in the gasoline. Well, you know, oil and gasoline, well, gasoline is a function of oil. When you refine oil, you get kerosene, diesel, and gasoline. I don't think a lot of people know that. So it does burn off, and it is, I will say it does leave a sooty residue if the exhaust is against something that because you're burning oil. But the funny thing is, and their argument is that you know in the United States, because it's landscaping services who are
we've gone from CalFarts to landscaping is now...
Well, I say this report is discriminatory against Latinx people, because a lot of your landscapers in California are Latinx. But we won't go there. But, the funny thing is they say Americans continue to use them because they're cheap, and I'll tell you why Americans continue to use them. Because a 60-volt leaf blower or a 60-volt electric weed whip lasts 20 minutes. You can use a minimal amount of two-stroke gas. And I'm talking a minimal, not even a gallon. It's not even a half gallon. The little tanks, I think, hold maybe a third of a gallon. And it'll run for 3 or 4 hours. Also, the electric weed whips, even the 60-volt ones, which are really cool, don't have the power of the gasoline ones.
That's absolutely true.
They absolutely do not have the power. So if you're in an area where you need to clean something up that is, you know, heavy brush or small trees that grow up under other trees and stuff, that's not going to happen. You can't put a brush blade on an electric weed whip and expect it to do anything. So a lot of the arguments of CARB don't make any sense, because they use the technology that makes, one, economic sense, but two, will actually do the job. And I'll tell you, if it was such a big concern, the fact that the lawn industry in the United States is what it is, and that people have to use chemicals and all of this to have a green lawn. My lawn stays green all year long. You know why it stays green all year long? One, I don't put any chemicals on it. Two, I have like 24 inches of topsoil because I live on a farm. And when we build subdivisions today, the first thing they do is they come in and they strip the topsoil off and they sell it. And so then when they lay sod, they're laying sod on dirt that has none of the requirements to grow grass. And the grass that they're growing, because my grass is orchard grass, which is native to where I live. Orchard grass is a legume. It's not actually a grass. And it you grow it, and that's what we make hay, grass hay out of, orchard grass hay. You also have timothy and alfalfa, which are all different hay grasses. But, you know, under my feet, if I want to walk outside bare feet in the grass, that orchard grass feels just like the fescue in your lawn. Yeah, do I have a little bit of clover in there? Do I care? No. The whole idea of having subdivisions, and the thing is, just like the idea that you have to have, if you want your house, you know, there's zoning laws that require that you have to be connected to the grid. The same thing happens that there are zoning laws and city ordinances almost everywhere that require you to have a lawn, have it be of, you know, it can't be green, can't be brown, and all this other stuff. And you talk about green, we waste more water watering grass that's growing on dirt that can't support it. And the way we are keeping it alive is by pouring chemicals on top of that. And those high nitrogen chemicals are running off into our sewers, which run off into our streams, run into our ponds, which are causing algae. I mean, it's just... But you tell somebody that you need to quit putting chemicals on their lawn, and their heads almost explode. And I don't care who they are. They could be the biggest tree hugger I've ever met. Their heads will literally explode.
To me, this is me. So you know my history and upbringing. The idea of paying a company to come out and spray my lawn is like I might as well just burn money.
Well, when I lived in a subdivision, I wouldn't do it. Now, I would fertilize the grass because I had to keep it green as part of the. Not only did I have to keep it green because of city ordinance, but I had to keep it green because of the stupid homeowners association, which is another thing I believe is illegal. It just needs to be challenged at the state Supreme Court levels and then taken to the federal Supreme Court. But, you know, I hate putting chemicals on the lawn. You know, just for the fact that we've always had dogs who go outside, the fact that we live on a farm. My neighbor, he has a 5-acre parcel that's adjacent to my farm. And he has the lawn company come out. Because he has a lawn company come out, when it rains, the chemical gets washed into my pond and I get huge algae blooms in my pond, which then means I have to put potassium nitrate in the pond to kill the algae, which then makes the fish that we have in the pond uneatable. You know, you can't eat them because potassium nitrate's poisonous to humans. It doesn't kill the fish, but it kill you. And luckily, it's not in an area where the horses graze, but I wouldn't be able to use that property. And I actually have talked to my local county's department I forget what department they're called, because I don't believe he can actually do that because the runoff affects an agricultural operation. But you know how it is. It's that catch 22. He's an okay neighbor except for that. And so do you want to piss your neighbor off over that? Someday it might push me too far and I will. But you know how it goes. So I think I'm going to end it at my rant against spraying lawns. I think the people, I don't mind mowing the lawn because, you know, when you mow a lawn, the grass actually does better when you mow it. Now, if you mow it down like it looks like a grass green, which I've known a lot of people in neighborhoods to do because they want it to look super even and all this stuff, that's not good for the grass because it can't retain moisture. But if the grass is too long, it retains bugs and everything else. And you know, and it's not so much that we want all bugs to go away, but you don't want to retain fleas and ticks, which is what you'll get, at least in the eastern, southeast, and midwest of the United States. But the whole idea of spending money to make your lawn look weed-free and everything else to a non-native species, and it's a holdover. So I don't usually talk about this, but it was actually one of the better episodes. So True TV used to have Everybody Hates Adam.
Adam Ruins Everything.
Everybody Hates Adam. Adam Ruins Everything. same damn thing. But he had an episode about lawns and how bad lawns are. And the thing is the only reason we do lawns today is because back in the 1600s, 1700s, the big estates in Europe had lawns and they wanted this to use this non-native grass. And which, again, like the fescue that you want to have in your lawn is not native to the United States. So that being said...
It's just so dumb. We have AstroTurf that looks just like regular grass. If you must have a lawn that looks like that,
yeah.
Seeing as we don't have topsoil that's worth the crap anyway, just put in AstroTurf and be done with it.
I agree. But again, city zoning laws and homeowners associations are probably the biggest ones, because what they do is when they build, you know, they create a homeowners association to pay for the green spaces. And so the homeowner associations, they don't do a whole lot for the homeowners most of the time. You know, who cares if your mailbox is green instead of white or whatever. But a lot of times the covenant as part of that, when you move into a subdivision, says that, you know, within 6 months of moving in, you must either sod or have grass growing in your yard. And a lot of people, you know, they always sod the front yards as part of it because that's the curb appeal. But a lot of the front yards die and people have to have them resodded because sod, again, it's a non-native species. Then we're stripping it off ground that had really good topsoil to grow it in, and we're moving it to a place where there's no nutrients at all. And a lot of times, builders will sod a lawn that isn't even rotivated, meaning that the soil isn't broken up, and so it's big clumps of soil and rock and everything. I've actually...
They literally installed the stuff like carpet.
Yeah. I have literally rolled sod up at properties to go through and pick up rocks that sod will not grow in. I mean rocks that are fist size or bigger.
That's should be criminal on the part of the builder.
Yeah. Well, I actually think we talk about, you know, being green and all this, but I think the building industry is at fault, because if they would not remove the topsoil, grass and stuff would grow, which would ease erosion and everything else, even these non-native species. And you would need to use a lot less chemicals. But because when they rezone land for builders to build on it, there's no city ordinances or anything that says that you cannot remove the topsoil. You know, and that's part of the things. Because where do they build subdivisions? Most subdivisions were built on former farms where either the farmer died or the family retired from farming and they sold it off because nobody wanted to take the business over. And so there's a lot of great topsoil, and the builders look at a way to recoup the money that they spent on buying the property, and that's what they do. And I don't begrudge them trying to get every dime out of it, but I do begrudge the fact that here's the kicker. The government works against the person buying the house,
yeah,
as opposed to working against the people who are building the houses to sell.
It ultimately just comes down to good stewardship of the land.
Well,
and the builders have a responsibility.
They do.
To do that.
They do.
They flat out do.
They and do, but they don't. No builder does.
No.
I throw builders up there with real estate agents and lawyers. They're just not people to trust. So, with that being said, maybe some builders will give us some feedback and
I'd love that.
Call me an asshole online, which I would love.
Bring it.
Yeah. So give us some feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
Listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.